Filibuster is supported through Patreon by listeners like you. Check us out at patreon.com/filibuster. We also get support from the Ehrlich Law Office, discrimination, wage, and litigation solutions for the District of Columbia and Northern Virginia. They handle workplace discrimination, non-competition and non-solicitation litigation, civil rights, and a whole lot more. For a free consultation, go to ehrlichlawoffice.com/filibuster.
You know, respect to Harry Caine, congrats to him, but he ruined for me what was going to be a really fun afternoon of Schadenfreude. Well, Schadenfreude and staying home with my sick kid, which was less fun. This was a nice respite. He denied me my respite by, you know, saving England and bringing joy to millions of people in the UK. So I can't be that mad at him, but for the longest time, I think ever since I spent a semester in England, they have been my favorite team to root against. Not because I particularly dislike them, just because they have this quadrennial cycle of we're garbage, we suck, we're trash, we're never going to do anything, we should fire the manager, ditch all the players in the national team and start over. And then somehow, over the course of a few years, in between World Cups, they end up amping themselves up to, we're going to win it this year. This is our year. And this year, it's a little different. This year, they have a younger team, but you can still feel it that we're different this year. It's going to be great. It came a little later, and then they went out and very nearly didn't beat Tunisia until a, you know, stoppage time winner from Harry Caine. But I feel like that's just going to make the cliff even steeper down the line, and it's gonna be fun for me. I'm just saying that right now. I love rooting against England.
Did you guys notice the sheer volume of mosquitoes and gnats and whatnot flying around the players in that game?
How could you not?
It was unpleasant to look at. I can only imagine being out in it. It is disgusting.
And that's even with the multiple times that they've sprayed down the entire stadiums that they've mentioned on the broadcast. So apparently summer in Russia is just full of bugs.
Yeah, it depends on where you go. But yeah, apparently a lot of Russia, a lot of areas where the tundra is like just when you're just south of tundra areas. I don't know the full reason for it, but apparently those regions of the world develop just a massive mosquito problem in the summer. Alaska apparently has a huge mosquito problem to the point that I think the joke is that it's the state bird. It's like one of those kind of things.
Right.
But yeah, like when I heard that they were going to use a helicopter to drop a bunch of insecticide on the stadium in Russia, my first thought, you know, honesty was, I don't know if that's such a good idea for like the people that are going to be there, because I don't know that the Russian government is the most trustworthy in terms of what chemicals they might toss around. But then it looks like maybe they didn't have strong enough chemicals to get rid of the mosquitoes in the first place. So I guess the people
there, they used the wrong chemicals. It's possible that the mosquitoes all survived and the people in attendance will all get cancer.
So yeah, we've created literal superbugs.
It's possible. I mean, anything is possible in this day and age.
Is it possible that some of the people in attendance will turn into mosquitoes?
Or perhaps mansquitoes?
Well, if this is like a Kafka sort of situation, I would say it's less likely because the Czechs didn't get into the tournament. But, you know, you can't rule it out. Someone might wake up and not be sure whether they're just having a dream of being a mosquito or if they are a mosquito.
Well, I'm just referencing the sci-fi original movie Mansquito.
I was referencing Kafka.
Well, I know that.
Did Kafka write Mansquito?
We can't rule it out.
I think we can.
There could be Kafka tome sitting in an archive somewhere that the sci-fi original TV producers somehow found and wrote up and stole.
You know, I'm going to need some evidence.
I like the idea. I like the idea of going through a revered author's final half-written manuscripts and finding a script for Mansquito or something along those lines. That, I think, would make me extremely happy if that was the case. If it was like, you know, which one was it? There was one of these, like, post-Sharknado movies that came out. There was a movie where the shark, the evil shark was killed and it was a ghost. And the ghost got into, or the ghost didn't want to leave water because it was a shark. And so it got into the public water supply and at one point got into like an office water cooler. But it could still kill people somehow, despite being a ghost in inside water. And not through drowning them, but through like biting them.
So I literally Googled the phrase ghost shark, and that is in fact the name of the film.
Okay. I wasn't sure that it was ghost shark, but I've seen this movie while drunk on Halloween, and it just came on after some other movies. And I was like, what is happening here? And then once my mind came to grips with the fact that it was a movie about a ghost shark who was trapped in water, I did not change the channel. I said, okay, I'm writing this one all the way to the end. And it was just as stupid as it sounds.
Going back to Mansquito,
like an 1800s author of some kind, like William Faulkner, his last manuscript was just about a ghost shark trapped in water.
Going back to Mansquito, I feel like it's a combination of I forced this bot to read thousands of pages of Kafka and watch thousands of hours of sci-fi original movies, and this is what happened.
But Mansquito is one of the very first. It is like the Ur manuscript for sci-fi original movies.
And that explains that.
Which makes it even more delightful.
Makes it even more something.
I haven't seen it in 13 years, so don't at me about
welcome in.
Opinion.
This is Filibuster, the Black and Red United and sci-fi original movies podcast. I'm Adam Taylor, joined as always by Ben Bromley and Jason Anderson. We're all from blackandredunited.com, where we cover DC United, and that's what we're talking about tonight. As always, they played a wild, thrilling, weird, insert descriptor here, match against Toronto FC last Wednesday. 4-4 draw there after leading 3-0. Yeah, it was quite a thing. We're going to talk about that in the first segment. In the second segment, we will break down we'll preview DC United's upcoming Open Cup game this week against the Purple Lions of Orlando City. That's Wednesday night at the Soccerplex. Before we do anything, though, Jason, what are you drinking?
It sucked outside today. It was very hot and humid and just deeply unpleasant to be out at all. And when our weather in this region gets like that, the only solution is to go to your gin and put that in something else. So I have myself a gin Ricky. With Tanqueray, it's doing what it was supposed to do, which is to refresh me and rejuvenate me a little. I don't feel like I'm carrying another Jason on my back everywhere, just from the heat and the oppressive nature of our summers.
Ben, what are you drinking?
So I had two cookouts this weekend, one with some friends, one just with myself for Father's Day. And at the first one, my friends brought over some beer because I was providing the, we smoked some hamburgers and then seared them. And then I cooked hot dogs for the children as well. But they left me some Sweet Baby Jesus from Duclaw Brewery. And I love a good peanut butter stout, so that's what I'm enjoying.
That's good. It is the opposite of the kind of beer I would want today, though.
Yeah. It is also disgusting here.
Yeah, I feel you've always got like a little more humidity and a little higher temperature at any given time.
I don't know.
Usually. I feel like Richmond's got to be like a couple degrees warmer all the time.
Probably.
Permanent state of thing that can never change.
As for me, I have a mezcal mule tonight. I had lime, but no club soda. The only sparkling beverage I had was ginger beer, so I keep missing out on my gin Ricky by not having the proper ingredients. This is poor planning on my part every single week. It's becoming a theme. But I'll make do with a mezcal mule that's pretty tasty in its own. Let's talk about soccer. Probably the weirdest MLS game this year went down Wednesday night in Toronto, DC United, that team that's last in the East, flying directly from the West Coast on short rest, playing their 10th road game of the year out of 12 to start, came out and hung three on Toronto FC, the defending champions of everything except CONCACAF. Just came out on fire, put three up in the first half, and then the second half happened. They allowed TFC to come all the way back 3-3, and then somehow, miracle of miracles, scored a fourth goal, only to allow Toronto FC to equalize again. And then DC United almost got a fifth, just because. That didn't happen because Yamil Assad's nervous system was too busy keeping him alive after about a million minutes over the last week, and he couldn't kick the ball. I'm not even blaming him. I'm not even mad about it. He ran himself into the ground. But this game was a night I think a lot of people watching aren't going to soon forget. That is if they can remember it, because, Jason, it was a little bit dreamlike.
It was weird. It was a weird game to come to grips with. The fact that things went so well for United, and it wasn't even that it was an accident. It wasn't like they just stumbled into some goals. They were making these goals happen. They were forcing Toronto into bad positions. They were taking the ball off Toronto with their high pressure. They really looked in complete control for 45 minutes. And then TFC obviously made some pretty big changes. At halftime, they pulled Zavaleta for Toussaint Ricketts. And it was like, there was a heavy wind, and all of the goals except for United's fourth were scored in the goal that was being attacked by this pretty savage wind going across the field. But I don't think this was it wasn't like the wind was so pronounced that, the ball was doing strange things or anything. You could only blame the environment a very small amount. I think mostly it was just this bizarre mix of United being really good at going forward to start games, and then very mentally fragile later. And so you end up with this, the emotional state that I was in at the end of the game was not even mad or amused. It was just stunned. When DC scored a goal, the fourth goal, I didn't even say, I didn't celebrate. I was just like, oh my God, they scored a goal. They haven't done anything for like half an hour. They haven't gone forward for half an hour. It's just been unrelenting pressure. And then they managed to walk the ball into the back of the net, and then they still don't end up winning the game. It was an utterly bizarre game played at a really, really, really high tempo. I mean, TFC completed over 650 passes, and yet it wasn't like they had 80% of possession. DC still had 338 passes. They still had an 81% passing accuracy. So this game was just played at this breakneck pace for the entire game. It's just that one team was pushing their foot down on the gas in the first half, and then it's like they switched seats and the other team was hammering away for the second half. It was just a collectively strange game. Everyone in the game got kind of caught up in the strangeness of it, and that's one of the ways you end up with a game that ends up 4-4 and could have ended up like 7-6.
Ben, what was your experience of this game? I have a theory that this World Cup has been kind of weird. There's been some weird games in the World Cup, and this game happened the day before the World Cup kicked off, and I think it was just a little taste of what was coming. How did you experience this one?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. There have been some breakneck games, such as the Costa Rica game that we saw recently. That was an insane game. My experience of it was, unlike Jason, I was fairly mad at the end of the game. Just the fact that it was there for the grabbing, even against the defending MLS Cup champs. Going up 3-0 is an insane lead to lose, and now DC United has done that multiple times recently. Because the Seattle game from last year was a similar situation as well. And we'll probably get into eventually, maybe not in this podcast, maybe down the road, whether or not we think it's a coaching thing, if it's a roster construction thing, whether or not it's a bit of both, which is the most likely situation. But I left the game frustrated and annoyed and mad and ready for something to happen.
Well, let's build up to that in this episode. Let's start at the beginning. What worked so well in that first half? DC United came out and Toronto had their chances early, but DC United definitely had the better of the chances and actually put them away. Not all of them. They left at least a goal, maybe two, on the table even. They could have had four or five in the first half. That's how good in the attack DC United were. Jason, what was it that was working?
The off-the-ball movement was really good. When TFC would send numbers forward, DC managed to turn them over right at the right time where, maybe someone from TFC is thinking, like, I'll hold, and then they see a window where it's like, oh, I should jump into the attack. And then right as they're doing that, the ball gets turned over, and DC is immediately attacking the space that was abandoned by whoever that was, be it, you know, a central midfielder or right back or left back. They were really accurate in picking out runners over distance to open the field up. And they were just really clinical in breaking out on the counter. They weren't taking an extra touch. They weren't missing, you know, they weren't missing someone's intentions, where if you needed the ball in space, the pass was in space. It wasn't a pass where someone had to slow down and collect the ball and then move on. Just everything seemed to be clicking. The high press was effective forcing Toronto to turn the ball over in their own defensive third. It just was one of those games where everything is going exactly according to plan. And it's a rare thing to see it work that well, because, I mean, we've all seen enough soccer at this point where we know that it's difficult. It's a hard sport to get to work correctly that often and to that degree. So it was a little bit of a charmed occasion where it wasn't luck. It was just, if everyone has a good night at the same time, this is the kind of thing that can happen. TFC seemed surprised by DC's approach, which was not anything abnormal for them. It was still principally a counterattacking approach with the occasional attempt to high press when the moment was right. And it wasn't like they fielded unusual players in unusual roles. It was pretty much like, this is what DC's game plan is supposed to look like when it works correctly. And TFC was, for reasons I don't understand, not really prepared at halftime or in the first half. And that's how, when all those things kind of come together, you can end up with a team that has struggled all season being 3-0 up against an extremely talented team like Toronto.
One thing that I thought was interesting is the very different ways the three goals came about. The first goal wasn't really a counterattacking goal. DC United strung a lot of passes together, so much so that they got one of those tweets from the league Twitter account with sped up video stringing all the passes together before the actual incisive pass that sets it up. So it was nice to see United break a defense down, kind of move them around a little bit, and then exploit the gap that they created. The second goal, Paul Areola header, I think it just won goal of the week. Early cross on a counter from Zoltan Stieber to the head of Paul Areola, who, for a little guy, really good in the air when he has to be. And then the third goal, high press, Darren Maddox pokes the ball away from a defender in his own box. And the ball bounces around a little bit before Maddox is able to smash it home. Just three very different goals that I think are kind of the ways you want to score from open play, which was nice to see. Less nice to see was what happened in the second half. Toronto, like Jason said earlier, made a change, pulled out Zavaleta, who was a disaster for Toronto that entire first half.
Yep.
And then they put in Tosin Ricketts up top, and he wasn't that much of a factor on the score sheet, but he, having a true center forward,
up top, and possibly even more so dropping Victor Vasquez into the midfield to pull some strings, made a huge difference. Toronto bombed forward and put DC United on their heels, whether they wanted to be or not. And that was really the story of the second half, I thought.
Yeah, and I think what it changed where the numbers on the field were, which sounds like a very basic thing. I mean, you pull a defender, you add a forward, of course, that's the case. But I think what it did it allowed TFC to prevent DC's breakouts on the counter. And so instead of it being TFC would attack and then DC would win the ball and break out, and then TFC would have to defend for a little while, it just was an unrelenting constant. You know, DC couldn't get two or three passes together before something would go wrong. The ball would go out, someone would, you know, cough it up, turn it over, and then it's back to defending again. And I think that, you know, on one hand, as much as TFC deserves to be criticized for having no real apparent preparation for DC United in the first half, they were really, really smart in how they adjusted to what was going wrong for them. And they just made the game about, and it became like an offense versus defense drill. They just made the game about 45 minutes of sustained, almost constant attacks. And eventually, you know, you throw in DC's a pretty apparent fragility when they've got the lead at this point. That, you know, this is a team that doesn't believe they can hold on to a lead very easily right now. They're not confident in holding on to a good situation. And TFC on the other side is still, you know, as much as their season hasn't gone according to plan, this is still a mentally very strong, very confident team. They have there's no hesitation in their ability to believe in themselves. And they go in at halftime and think, we can still get something out of this game. And DC United goes in at halftime thinking they can still get something out of this game. And right, it comes true. And so, you know, it's, you know, credit to Greg Vanney for making the big adjustment. And it is frustrating to see that, you know, United maybe waited too long to make their adjustment. I know a lot of people were upset that Acosta came out for Junior Moreno, but I would point out that the way the first 15 minutes of the second half went, Acosta was basically not involved in the game at all. And making a move, if anything, could have come a little earlier, because United needed to stem the tide and slow things down a little bit before. I mean, by that point, the train was kind of, you know, there's plenty of momentum behind it. You know, you're already going downhill at that point. It's hard to stop it when it gets going. You know, a sub five, even in the 50th minute, I mean, you end up with a probably an issue in terms of whether it's Lucho or somebody else coming off. They're not going to be happy getting sub 5 minutes of the second half, but you explain it to them, like, look, this game is clearly, we're playing a completely different game in the second half, and TFC is setting all the terms. They're, you know, they're storming the castle right now, and we have to change what we're doing and change our approach. And I think in this case, the wait was a little too long to make that move. It's either that, or you have to find a way to get an attacking player like Acosta involved again, and he can, you know, change the game by going forward the other way. You know, people tend to think of a number 10 as someone who can slow the game down when you need it, but that's not who Lucho is. He doesn't slow the game down. Right. He can control the ball in traffic, but he's usually looking for a killer pass.
And so DC United tried to hold on and tried to hold on. I think that one of the other things that Toronto FC's shift did is it allowed Jonathan Osorio a little bit more freedom, and he scored the first goal for Toronto on a late run into the box. And Toronto obviously also got some good breaks. The Jovinko shot that knuckled, it wasn't a bending shot. It was a knuckling shot that happened to knuckle really hard right at the post instead of going wide. So hard that it bounced back the direction it came and right to Victor Vasquez, who put it into the roof of the net. Actually, both their first goals went into the roof of the net, a millimeter difference on the shot, and it goes wide. Obviously, that didn't happen. They scored. What happened is what happened. I want to drill down more on United's inability to hold a lead. Jason, you mentioned the mental fragility. Ben, what else is there to talk about on this front?
My problem came. My main problem came down to the inability of basically of most of the back line to defend. I was rewatching the goals this evening, and on the first and third goal, just how deep Frederick Briant drops without having anyone to mark. He's trying to mark space. He's trying to mark the ball, but on the first goal, it's either he's about the only man who could have stepped up and marked, because everyone else had somebody, except maybe Yamil Assad could have made the run from way out in midfield, but that's not his guy. Briant is trying to cut out the pass, but by trying to cut out the pass, he left the late runner just completely wide open.
Well, when it's a late runner, I think I put more emphasis on the midfield. When it's a late runner, if it's somebody making the near post run, that's the center back's job, even the early back post run. But he had
somebody in front of him.
When it's somebody running out of midfield, it's a midfielder's job to track that run. And I think it's both. Like, I think they're both problems here, because sure, Briant had so much other issues in the game. And
right. And
go ahead.
And then my issue with him on the third goal was a similar thing. He must be being told to do this, so maybe it's a coaching thing, that he keeps pedaling, like running backwards and not marking a person trying to cut out the pass, and then he again leaves space wide open. But it's not just him. It's also O'Neill Fisher got caught ball watching on the second goal. He could have like turned around and seen where the rebound went. And who got destroyed on the Haglund goal? So he jumped over somebody's back. Was that Mora?
Yeah, it was either Mora.
Yeah, Mora ended up one on one with the best aerial player TFC has, which is never an ideal
right situation. And another, and then on the final goal, just to condemn the whole defense writ large, after the corner is recycled and a couple of times, it's eight guys all running out in the general direction of the ball, and it's Patrick Mullins has to try and run back to cover both Haglund and somebody else at the far post, and there's nobody else there. So that's just an indictment of the entire defense.
Yeah, I think that was Osorio again making the back post run. If Haglund hadn't been there, Osorio might have been able to turn that ball in himself. Yeah, the team looked beat. I wonder how, in this instance, I wonder how much fatigue had to do with it. I mentioned Assad being completely gassed by the end of the game. He played, Jason, I think you were the one that pointed this out to me. He played 210 minutes last week in the Open Cup game, played 90 minutes in Seattle, and then played
between the Open Cup and Seattle.
Oh, 210 between those two games, and then 90 minutes against Toronto on Wednesday. That is a lot of games and or a lot of minutes in 8 days. And Assad's a high work rate player. He's not going to be
right.
He's not Andrea Pirlo, just, you know, holding a glass of wine in the center circle. He is getting up and down. I was surprised he didn't drop dead at the hour mark, let alone making it, you know, in front of goal in the 90 or in stoppage time.
It's funny because he ended up, and I'm not sure he's the DC player I would have picked to put on Team of the Week, but he ended up getting, from MLS's staff, they put him on the Team of the Week.
You score two goals against the defending champs, you get Team
right,
of the Week.
And was generally pretty dangerous throughout this game. Yeah. I mean, the two goals weren't really an accident. So, you know, it's a testament to his fitness levels, but I do think that team-wide, I think this is a group that could have used some rotation, but at certain spots where the demands are the highest, there aren't really healthy players to rotate in. You know, the fullbacks, there are no fullbacks to turn to. There was a moment in this game where Mora got, he needed some treatment for a moment, and it was like, you know, they're going to have to bring Jalen Robinson into play right back, that a position we know he's not comfortable in, and O'Neill Fisher is going to have to go to left back, which is a position that he has been worse at than right back when he's played over there this season. And that's the best solution we have. It's that, or put Robinson in the middle and play Steve Birnbaum as a fullback and take it back to 2015 was the last time we saw Birnbaum having to play fullback for an extended period of time. So,
yeah,
it, you know, with the number of players who are missing due to injury or what have you right now. And, you know, it's a funny thing because it's not like it's not like a list where it's just a bunch of people with hamstring strains. You've got, you know, De Leon's got a, you know, a knee injury that's unspecified, but didn't look like a muscular thing. It looked like something else. So that doesn't hurt you or doesn't help. Kofi Opare twisted his ankle in training. You know, that's one that you can't really legislate for. You know, Chris Odoi-Achim needed a surgery to relieve compartment syndrome. There's, you know, not a lot you can do there. You know,
yeah, that's just a rough one.
Yeah, and it's just, it, you know, Segura's injury was, by all accounts, a contact injury in a challenge. Knauss has a knee injury that was probably something, is probably some kind of challenge in preseason. You know, there are no, the only player listed with a muscular injury on the injury report right now is Taylor Kemp, and his is still one that has required a surgery and multiple specialists, and we don't even know exactly what it is. Because at different times it's been a hernia or a groin or a hip. So, you know, it just so happens that because United's roster is, you know, it's not filled out. They don't have 30 players under contract. This is a situation you find yourself in with six players. And, you know, of that group, you could say Kemp, Knauss, Segura, De Leon, Opare, those guys are making the 18 if everyone's healthy in a lot of cases. So, you know, it's really tough when you get a 3-game week and you've got 20 players to pick from, and you don't have any fullbacks to rotate. I mean, the only rotation they made in this game was Durkin. And it's, I was surprised that Bruno Miranda didn't get a start, but I understand why we ended up only seeing, one player cycle in. It's just the DC's lot in life. I mean, we had, I want to say when Mora went down, Paul Areola was playing right back for a little while. Should probably consult my notes on that. Yeah, it you know, things got weird in this game and it didn't relent. And it might have helped to have one more fresh player out there to weather the storm. But, you know, going back to when, you know, Ben was upset at the end of the game. I think it's completely reasonable to be upset. In my mind, though, it's sort of a double think going on where on one hand, it's a 3-0 lead and there's no reason that you should give up a 3-0 lead to anybody. You know, if you put DC United out against Real Madrid and you give them a 3-0 lead at halftime, they should hold on to that game. But at the same time, they did go to Toronto and get a point, which I think none of us were expecting. And so there
it's
is
one of those, if you tell me beforehand what the result would be versus how it actually went down.
Right. And we've had a lot of those, in recent times, which is, I mean, this is a frustrating team. And so I can understand why people are upset because this team isn't, they're not getting, it's not a 0-0 draw where you're like, well, that was boring. It's a, you know, this incredible drama where it's up and down and you have, you know, a golden opportunity to take 3 points and then you throw it away and then you take it back again and then you throw it away again. They're not playing quiet, boring games. This is not the the DC of, you know, 2014, 2015, where they just ground games out and even the wins were kind of boring and uneventful. This is a team that every week provides you with some sort of wild drama. It's just not necessarily wild drama that ends in a positive manner for DC United fans. There's promise. If the team was bad, if they were just a bad team, then they wouldn't be so frustrating. You would just be like, this team sucks and that's it. But they have the promise to do better. And so it's much more frustrating that they're so close and then they can't quite get over the line.
Right. If this were 2010 or 2013 again, I'd be depressed, not mad, but this team has so much more talent, far more talent than either of those teams ever had. And so that's what makes me mad is the fact that there is so much talent, especially attacking talent. And it's it's just not working right now.
There are two things I want to touch on here. One is that progress is very rarely linear, and I think this team is a very good evidence of that, because I think they are better now than they were at the beginning of the year. They're certainly better than they were last year, but it doesn't show all the time. You see glimpses of the promise in the first half against Toronto, and then you see that they're not there yet. and you get those fits and starts, and I think that that's going to continue for at least the next several games, if not for the rest of the season. Hopefully they figure it out and create a new floor for themselves, a new higher floor for themselves, compared to where they are now. But, you know, we're still seeing that progress is not a linear process. The other is going back to the depth thing from earlier. It's really, I guess, part of the weirdness of this game that outside midfielder, the wing is where we felt the lack of depth more than any other place on the field, which is not what I would have expected coming into the season with Paul Areola, Yamil Assad, Zoltan Stieber, all fighting for starting minutes. We managed to get them all in the field at the same time, and I think the team is better for that. But there's not as much depth at that outside spot right now as a result, which is probably part of the reason why DC United is out shopping for a young DP qualifying attacker. And I do want to shout out one listener who is exiled_MLS on Twitter, who went out and found John Murillo, a Venezuelan playing for Benfica right now, who looks like he checks all the boxes that DC United is looking for, as reported by Steve Goff in the complimentary piece to join Wayne and Rooney in the summer transfer window. I don't know much about him. I'm sure we'll hear more about him and some other candidates in the coming days and weeks, but
give me a fullback or a center back for that amount of money first. Or even half that money.
Yeah, you can spend half that money and not worry about, you know, a DP slot. You can get a TAM center back or a sub TAM fullback even.
Or a DP. I'd be fine with a DP in either of those positions. That's the need right now. A young attacker would be great, especially if they think they can flip him in a couple of years, but this team this year, especially with Rooney coming in theory, needs a fullback or a center back.
I think this week showed that with more three-game weeks coming up in the future, they need more depth at outside midfielder as well, because Olsen wasn't comfortable taking Assad off the field in three straight games for, 300 minutes? And that's, you know, that's not sustainable. So we need both. We need to increase our depth at the back and at the front as well.
Yeah, I mean, personally, at this point, I think I would rather have a TAM attacking signing and more of a young DP fullback. We talked about Milton Valenzuela clones at least once. But if it's the other way around, it's not a disaster, but they have to do something. If we come through the big signing, you know, press conference like last year, and there's a bunch of players and Wayne Rooney or whoever's up there, and then we talk to the other guys as well. If none of those guys is a fullback or a center back or something defensive, then, you know, buckle in for a bunch more 4-4 games, I guess, because, I think this team needs to upgrade at the top line of its defense. This is not about improving depth. They need to improve their depth by pushing down from the top, so everyone moves down a level. Yeah. So that we're talking about De Leon, Fisher, and Mora all fighting for one spot rather than those guys and another new guy being all battling for time. The new guy needs to be someone who is clearly going to improve the defense without a doubt. But right now we don't have any, there's no active rumors that I know about linking DC to a defender specifically. So
hopefully it'll be like the Paul Ariola signing from last year.
Right. You know, or Zoltan Stieber that just sort of came up at the end. Like, oh, hey, by the way, we'll just throw this one in as well. I know that, I mean, they're not, you know, any team that's given up as many goals as DC, no one's lacking awareness in the idea that they need to improve the individual players. They do also just need to improve the defensive structure, their ability to adjust when teams really throw the kitchen sink at them. To such an extent that I wouldn't mind hearing, like, we've signed a coach who's known for his defensive game planning, things like that. I wouldn't mind hearing that as an addition to the staff, because, you know, right now this team is very good at going forward and very bad at having to go back and defend their goal. And the effort is there. It's just the thought process for individual players isn't right. And in this game, it wasn't so much the individual errors as just the team structure wasn't able. They weren't able to adjust their structure to deal with what TFC was doing in the second half. And they're lucky in a way. They're lucky they got away with a draw because they pretty much didn't mount an attack until their goal. And even when they scored, I remember feeling on some level like, yeah, but TFC's still got a fourth goal in them. Like, there's going to be 6 minutes of stoppage time. That's enough time for Toronto to score. And it didn't even take them that long to get the goal. This is a team that needs better defensive structure and better defensive players. And that's, you know, if they can make that happen, if they can improve the individuals as well as improve the structure, then there's enough firepower on this team to actually make some noise down the stretch. But it can't be, well, we added Rooney and we added this young designated player and we'll just try and score goals and figure it out at the back. That's not going to do it.
Heard it here, folks. First, Mats Hummels coming to Buzzard Point. If only. That's it for this segment. We will be right back to preview the U.S. Open Cup game against Orlando City. Stick around. This is Filibuster, the Black and Red United podcast. Hey, Ben, you wouldn't say this is a hostile work environment, would you? You can tell me.
Depends. I mean, well, I should ask you. I mean, are goats hostile?
I think goats are hostile. I think that they are secretly trying to take over the world. But if this were a hostile work environment, or if I were trying to steal your wages or do something else nefarious.
Oh, you are.
I'm really not. But in a workplace environment, you know who to call, right? Because you live in the District of Columbia or Northern Virginia.
I do. It's the Ehrlich Law Office.
It is the Ehrlich Law Office. They offer discrimination, wage, and litigation solutions in Northern Virginia and the District of Columbia, which means I can totally create a hostile work environment for Jason. Except, no, they wouldn't want me to say that. That would be bad. I do not want to create a hostile work environment for anyone. But Jason couldn't call them nonetheless because he lives in Maryland. Sorry, Jason.
I'll fight my way through this.
All right. They handle workplace discrimination, wage theft, non-compete clauses, and non-solicitation litigation. They handle civil rights and government takings and disability and education law. They handle a lot of things. And if you are interested in a free consultation, head to ehrlichlawoffice.com/filibuster. Welcome back to Filibuster. The greatest knockout soccer tournament in the globe is underway. Yeah, the quality of play might not match the Champions League, and it's got weird venues and odd match days and times that nobody can quite figure it out. But we love us, the U.S. Open Cup. See what I did there? See how I did that? This week, the round of 16 goes down, and our own national capital, Trash Pandas, will host the Central Florida Sea Cows. At least that's their names in an alternate universe. DC United host Orlando City at the Maryland Soccerplex Wednesday night. Go see it if you can. Stream it if you can't get out there. Michael Citro runs themainland.com on SB Nation. That's the Purple Lion flavored site on our network. So he's here to help us preview this game. Michael, welcome back to Filibuster.
Hey, it's good to be back, guys. I usually don't get invited back anywhere I've previously been, so appreciate it.
You know, we got to throw you a bone here now and again. What are you drinking?
Well, as befits a game coming up between two really bad teams, I'm drinking a bad beer. I'm drinking a Budweiser Freedom Reserve Red Lager, which is supposedly based on or inspired by a George Washington recipe. But I really feel bad for the Founding Fathers if they were drinking this.
You know,
times are tough.
I'm not going to question your choices, but I hope you reflect on the choices that brought you to that drink.
Yes, well, I'm gonna blame this on my wife. She wanted to test it out, and neither of us are impressed.
I have been that spouse before, so no judgment. I jokingly referred to Orlando City as the Sea Cows, and that's actually a name I've seen around. I've seen Orlando City logo mock-ups with Sea Cows on it, and I'm curious, what is this? What is this thing?
This was an April Fool's by the club a few years back when they announced that they were rebranding and came out with a sea cow on the traditional Orlando City logo. And this was, I think, before even MLS. So it just kind of became an inside joke, and people started asking for Sea Cows merchandise. And so the club said, money? Okay. And they started printing up shirts and scarves and stuff, and they've caught on.
Seems reasonable. I guess the biggest news out of Orlando at this point is Jason Kreiss being shown the door. Six-game winning streak followed by a six-game losing streak. I think the only draw you guys have is that week one result against us, against DC United. What are your thoughts on the firing, and where does Orlando City go from here?
Well, where Orlando City goes from here is a great question. I'll start with the firing itself. I think that I understand why it happened. This is very much a "what have you done for me lately" era for sports and just people in general. And you know, six losses in a row was pretty hard to take given the quality of the roster. But that said, most of those six games lost in a row were done without the club's only really viable proven striker in Dom Dwyer. He's just come back from injury. The bulk of the middle of that six-game skid was also down four center backs and the starting right back and the second string right back for a portion of that time. At one point, there was a defensive midfielder and a right back, a backup right back at that, playing center back for Orlando City for a couple of games. And then Yoshimar Yotun is off at the World Cup. And, you know, the last part of that is that four of those six games were on the road, including a trip that started for U.S. Open Cup to Miami, directly from Miami to Vancouver, directly from Vancouver to Montreal. And despite all of that, the team actually played well enough to probably win four of those six games. So to me, it was a little bit of a panic move by Orlando City. But again, I understand why they did it. It may have been necessary at some point, but I think as the players were just starting to return to health, Don Dwyer just came back, Jonathan Spector just came back, Lamine Sané should be coming back soon, as well as Scott Sutter, who just got cleared for full training participation. It seemed like a bad time to do it because the guy who won six games in a row was just about to get the guys back who helped him win those six games in a row.
Michael, you mentioned a lot. You know, there's some really big names that came in this offseason. This was a roster that Orlando, the organization, seemed to feel like they built a winner, and that's why you end up with a very quick trigger pull when it comes to Kreiss being fired, or at least quick for MLS. Normally, we're used to all across the league, guys can have a six game losing streak and still stick around for a while. Shout out to Jay Heaps. But one of the players that I'm most curious about that I, when he was signed, I thought was a masterstroke, and it hasn't really worked out yet. Oriel Rosell has started to play. It took a while for him to get in the lineup, but it hasn't necessarily panned out just yet. What's going on there?
Yeah, the odd thing about bringing in Uri Rosell was that he seemed like he was assigning to bring in for the base of the diamond in a 4-4-2 diamond formation. Orlando City scrapped the diamond after three games into the season and started going to a 4-2-3-1. He's been playing in that defensive midfield next to Chris Nikita, and they kind of play the same role. So it's almost like they're trying to occupy the same space quite a bit. And ever since Yoshimar Yeotun went off to the World Cup, there's been a lack of really anyone willing to get into offensive spaces. Higuita has done it a few times and scored a couple of goals, actually, which is unusual for him. But, we haven't seen the Rosell, the full force of what he brought to Sporting Kansas City in his heyday there. But he still has that quality of where you'll look at the stats at the end of the night, and he's completed 7 out of 8 long passes and has a high percentage of passing overall. So he's still doing a very good job quietly most of the time. He's had a couple of bad games, but he's really kind of still a little bit behind the eight ball because he did start the season with an injury to his knee and has been slowly working his way back in. And the team has just had so many injuries, guys in and out of the lineup. He's really almost the casualty of chemistry problems at this point.
You mentioned the injuries, and I know that's been kind of an ongoing thing for Orlando since the club really came into the league. Is there any concern about what's going on as far as the training side with the team?
Yeah, I mean, this is something our fans always write to us about. There's got to be something else going on, but it's been across multiple coaches. It's been across multiple training staffs. It's been a couple of years ago, it was a rash of hamstrings, one hamstring after another. And this year it's been like a lot of different weird things. Spector got a concussion. Chris Schuler broke his arm. Another guy did his knee. Another guy did his quad. Another guy did his adductor. These are all different, very different injuries. So I don't know really what you can point to and say that's the problem right there. Obviously Spector's problem is he shouldn't bonk heads with people. I don't know what to tell these guys. It's like, you know, sometimes bad luck is just bad luck.
I guess I'll do something a little self-serving here. When we did our mock draft as a network, my pick for DC, even though I kind of suspected that they were going to trade their pick, we don't do that in ours. It would be utter chaos if you gave 23 bloggers the option to start trading picks. We would still be working on it, I feel like. But I picked Chris Mueller for DC United, and in real life, Orlando City took Chris Mueller. How has he done so far for the Lions?
Chris Mueller's been very good. He he's cooled off a little lately, but he had goals, three goals in 4 games, and he's just a kid that bust his hump out there every minute that he's on the pitch. He's still got a lot to learn. He's young, and the pro game is still an adjustment for him. But he works hard, and if you work hard on the pitch in MLS, you're gonna make some plays. And he always seems to be around the ball. He likes to get on the ball. He's a better passer than he is a scorer. And he's really, for a time, he kept the young designated player, Josue Coleman, off the field. So he was doing quite well. Of late, he's cooled off a bit, but I think you're going to expect sort of lulls from rookies. And, I expect that he'll go through another streak here at some point and score goals in a few games. But he's always dangerous around the net. He always works hard, and he's got a pretty darn good first touch, which is something that you don't see a lot out of these guys coming out of college.
So, Michael, we've talked a little bit about Jason Kreis, but let's talk about the man who's at least temporarily succeeding him. Bobby Murphy is the temporary head coach. Do you have any indication about what he's going to do? Is it going to be a similar style to what Kreis has done? Is he going to try and make a name for himself and try and grab the head coaching job? What's his deal?
I think Bobby knows that he's a placeholder. I think this organization will go out and try to make a big name signing. I think Scolari was the popular name that we've heard. Taylor Twellman tweeted out about him, although I have reservations about hiring somebody that will be 70 years old before MLS Cup is given out at the end of this season.
Although that makes sense from the Brazilian ownership.
Exactly. I think that Bobby is comfortable in just kind of holding on to the reins for a temporary time. He's always been a guy who liked to work with the academies and work with the young kids and sort of be that liaison between the top flight team and the academy. So I think you'll see him. I definitely think that he's a motivational guy. He's a high energy guy. The players all like him and they respect him. But I mean, he's coached 4 MLS games before between Heath and Kreis, and he went 0-1-3 in those games. So he's still yet to taste victory. It's kind of up in the air what he's going to do with U.S. Open Cup. This is kind of a new situation for him. Will he put out a really strong side and try to win it and not worry as much about league games, or will he, you know, pull back and then maybe hold something back for Montreal after the loss at Montreal is going to pretty much necessitate that Orlando City gets a result when they come to Orlando. So it's going to be interesting to get out to training and get some clips of, and talk to him a little bit and see what his thinking is going into this set of games, because I'm almost at this point with a major coaching change in the middle of the year, you would almost think maybe U.S. Open Cup would be a little bit more prioritized, because it might seem like a better way to win a trophy, or at least a less difficult route.
Yeah, we know all about winning a U.S. Open Cup in an otherwise lost season. I guess my other question is, it is the Lewis Neal connection. How is Lewis Neal? Is he still with the organization? Is he coaching? What's he doing?
I think that Lewis Neal is going to end up playing indoor soccer, arena soccer in the MASL. Okay. But I could be wrong. He's kind of been kicking around. He was doing some broadcasting for the team, but there's not as much need for that now. Now that the USL side is sort of dormant this year, I think he's still kicking around. I wouldn't be surprised to see him, playing for the what do they call it? The Orlando Sea Wolves.
Do you think they're bringing back OCB in a year or two, or is that a unofficially done deal that it's just gone?
I think the plan is to bring them back in USL Division 3. That's certainly not anything official or anything that's imminent at this point, but my sense is that that's what they'd like to do.
And then I get my last real question before I got distracted is you talked about Scolari. In your mind, who would be among the list of realistic, but your top tier list of people you think that you would like to see Orlando City get for their full-time head coach?
I think my first call would be to Mark Dos Santos, who was the Sacramento Republic coach. San Francisco Deltas, who he led them in basically a lame duck year, led them to a championship. And I believe he's now an assistant under Bob Bradley with LAFC. He's a bright young guy, and I think that he's a guy that I would look at immediately because, you know, I think that some fresh blood would be good. And another guy that I would look at is a former Orlando City USL player who's been doing great things in the USL, is James O'Connor with Louisville City. But I'm sure that this ownership group would like to bring in somebody a little more well-known. I think that they feel some pressure to match what Atlanta United's done with Tata. So I think that that's pretty much the route they're going to go. I don't know that they're going to find that guy. I don't know if Scolari's that guy. At you know, like I said, he's 69 years old. A few years removed from Brazil's head coach, of course, famously lost on home soil 7-1 in the semifinals of the World Cup to Germany. But I mean, he does have a wealth of experience. He's a respected name. I don't know if he could, if he can get it done here or not. A lot of foreign coaches have not done well here. We'll see.
Speaking about Brazilians, I don't think Dunga has a job right now.
Yeah. I don't think he will have a job anytime soon.
I like Jason's audible ugh in the background there. So with all the question marks, the coach's style, the players on the field, the fact that it's an Open Cup game during a World Cup, if you were planning against Orlando City in this game, what would you be focusing on?
I would be focusing on laying back and hitting on the counter, because that's really what teams have done well against Orlando City. Vancouver feasted on that, albeit mostly late in the game. It's weird because you look at the score of that game and it was 5-2, but it was a 1-1 game with about 15 minutes to play, and it was a 2-1 game, I think, with 5 minutes to play. And then all of a sudden, pushing for that second goal and also being down a man, they just started just one after another, just plunking them in the net. So, you know, basically everybody that's done well against Orlando City has done it on the counter. You wait, and Orlando City will at some point make a critical mistake in the middle of the pitch, and with their fullbacks forward, they'll be stretched, and it'll be easy pickings at the other end. And quite frankly, Joe Bendik has not been as good this year as we've seen in years past. So he's not making the highlight reel saves that he has made in 2016 and 2017. So that's kind of what I would do. And I would pressure, if I'm going to pressure at all, I would pressure early in the match, because Orlando City seems to take up 10, 15 minutes to get into a match. And then from that point on, I would just sit behind the ball and wait for my opportunities to go the other way.
That actually lines up with DC United's usual pattern this year. High press early and then hopefully get a lead and then sit back. Two varying degrees of success on especially the latter part of that plan. It hasn't always worked. But if they pursue it, hopefully, you know, at least from our end, hopefully it works this time around. Michael, thanks for coming back on the show. Why don't you tell people where they can find you online?
Sure. You can read our stuff at themainland.com. That is Maine as on Lion's Mane, M-A-N-E, not M-A-I-N. We do like our lion puns over there. Find us on Twitter at themainland. And me personally, I'm at Mainland Michael. And of course, our podcast is available on iTunes and Google Play and all those other places. And it's the Mainland Podcast. And podcast is, again, a pun. P-A-W-E-D-E-A-S-T.
Puns on puns down there in Florida. find us at blackandredunited.com. Support us financially at patreon.com/filibuster. We're on iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever podcasts are available. Find us on Twitter at filibusterdcu for the podcast, at blackandredu for the website. Send your emails to filibusterpodcast@gmail.com. That's it for us. We will talk to you again real soon. For Jason and Ben, I'm Adam, and thanking Michael one more time. Say goodbye, Jason.
Hollywood, it's time for Ghost Shark 2.
It's not.
No, it is. Really
not. No, it's not.
Ghost Shark versus Mansquito.
All right, that I'm on board with.